Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. More than a quarter century after the Americans with Disabilities Act, this group of people remains underemployed, but not for lack of desire. Surveys find the vast majority want a job, but barriers remain. Companies may worry about the time training might take, or that these workers might need too many accommodations, or that they won't fit in with the rest of the team. Also, transportation can be a problem, especially in New Hampshire, where driving to work is often the only option. Now, a new UNH study looks at business practices and policies around this and finds that while supervisors are interested in hiring and training people with disabilities, upper management is more hesitant. Today in The Exchange, tapping into a talent pool often ignored, Granite Staters with Disabilities. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. John O'Neill joins us from New Jersey. He's Director of Disability and Employment Research at the Kessler Foundation, a national organization which helps connect people with disabilities with employment. And John O'Neill, really great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Also with us, Andrew Houghtonville. He's Director of Research at the Institute on Disability at UNH. He's also an Associate Professor of Economics at UNH and co-principal investigator of the Kessler Foundation survey that I mentioned on supervisor perspectives on hiring people with disabilities. And Andrew, it's good to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Kimberly Phillips, Project Director at the Institute on Disability at UNH. She also worked on that survey. And Kimberly, good to have you too. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Laura.
Well, all of you, before we get into all the details of this survey and some of the issues that come up when people with disabilities want to be employed, but sometimes face barriers. To you first, I think, Andrew, just make the case that even if I didn't know a single soul with a disability, this subject is important to me.
Well, as you look around the state, certainly these days there's lots of help wanted signs out. This is certainly a signal of the labor market shortage that we have in New Hampshire for a variety level of skill levels. Also, one thing to think about disability is also think about the aging population. You know, not everybody's born with a disability. Many, many people migrate into disability. So if you aren't a person with a disability, you may become one someday. So you as a person, as a worker, or as an employer should kind of think about that. And what you learn from working with people with disabilities many times translates into working with people who are more senior. And as the Social Security retirement age is lifted to 72 and beyond, these are things that we're going to have to consider, especially with the aging population in New
well,
Hampshire.
Well, so especially relevant then to New Hampshire. Not only you see help wanted signs everywhere, Andrew, so there's a resource there, but I've heard that that people in the disability rights community call the rest of us temps.
That's right.
Because eventually you're going to have some sort of a disability.
That's
so
right.
I'd love your perspective on this too, John. Again, you know, if you're at a cocktail party and somebody says, what do you do and why should I care? What would you say, John?
Well, I think one of the things I would say is that, you know, there are 56 million approximately people with disabilities in the United States, one of the largest minority groups. And also amongst people with disabilities, the rate of employment is only about 28%.
And you said 60 million. Sorry to jump in on you there, John, right? Is that what you said?
56.
56 million.
Yes.
Americans with disabilities. So go ahead. Yeah.
And the employment rate amongst this group is only about 28% at this point in time. And that is, in comparison to people without disabilities, of an employment rate of about 76%. And as you had mentioned, many surveys show that people with disabilities really do want to work. Yet the employment rate remains very low.
How do you have any insight or numbers, John, on of those 56 million Americans with disabilities, how many are actually capable of working? I'm guessing among some people, there's just no way the disability is too severe. Do you have any perspective on that?
Well, I think that many individuals who work in the employment sector with people who have disabilities would comment that there are very, very few who are incapable of working. Just the appropriate supports and access to the to employers is enough to really raise the employment rate considerably.
Well, and we'll definitely talk in a couple minutes about the survey that you all worked on that looks at supervisor perspectives on hiring and training this pool of workers. But what about you, Kimberly? From what I understand, you work, you know, sometimes on the ground with people. What's your perspective on why people who have no experience with disabilities should care about this?
Thanks, Laura. Well, actually, I would say that there are more people than you know who have disabilities, because disability is not always something we can readily identify. It may not be visible. So even if you think you don't know a single soul, that may not actually be the case. And the second thing is that employers becoming more accessible to people with disabilities helps everyone, not only people with disabilities, but these are practices that are really widely applicable that all of us would benefit from.
Well, I want to ask you about that in a second, but I'm glad you raised the issue of who we're talking about. So you got to give us a little bit more there, Kimberly. So I think that the image of a person in a wheelchair, everybody says, okay, accessibility, accommodation, but who else are we talking about? I mean, give us a sense of the range of disability that we're looking at.
Sure. Well, in this particular survey, we asked about disabilities that involve hearing, vision, ambulation, as you mentioned. And also we asked about cognitive disabilities, which could include mental illness or substance abuse disorder, learning disabilities, autism, ADHD. We really tried to cast a wide net.
Wow. Go ahead, Andrew. I can see you want to jump in.
Oh, that's okay. So it's as Kim said, it's a diverse net. And usually what sometimes, there's an old guy at Social Security who once said, if you have your head in your hands, you can work. And so it's really about, you know, the expectation to work. And so cognitive function, you know, mental function broadly, and physical function. And so the key is to try to figure out ways to accommodate changes in function. So a lot of times when we're doing our research, we don't want to think about specific diseases or things like that. We want to think about what people's capacities are and how to augment those capacities such that they're productive at work.
Now, give us a little more there, because that's interesting. So trying not to focus so much on what you can't
right.
do, but what you can do.
Well, and also just the things that people do in the workplace. So there's an NIH study that's been long in the works, where the function of an individual is broken down into eight parts. And it's, so it's, instead of diseases, it's really eight forms of function, such as relating to people at the workplace. So we look at those functions and then try to augment the functions with either training or education or supports or technology sometimes. And so it's really more about function. When you say, who are we talking about when we
right.
talk about people with disabilities, it's not diseases, it's not health issues. It's really people who do things differently, right? And then how do we support those individuals when they're in different environments, whether it's schools or the workplace or home?
Well, how would you answer that question, John, too? You know, who is in that 56 million figure that you gave us earlier?
Well, it includes, as Andrew and Kim have mentioned, a broad array of individuals with disabilities. And it includes individuals with can be intellectual disabilities, developmental disabilities, individuals who have mental health disabilities, as well as those with physical disabilities. It's a definition that casts a very, very wide net.
I want to invite our listeners to join us and then tackle the big question that we're looking at today, which is why this group of people tends to be, as you all have said, underemployed. The number for you to join us here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Especially if you have personal experience with this topic, either you yourself or a loved one has a disability, or you're an employer who's been looking at this issue, we're looking at what it takes to employ Americans with disabilities. And as we've heard, it's an issue in the Granite State, especially with an aging population. At some point, most of us will have some type of disability. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Again, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, John, getting to this underemployment issue, what's the big push behind it or the big reason behind it, John? Why do you think that this group of people is so underemployed, as you all have said?
Well, I think it's often employers may want to hire individuals with disabilities, and yet they oftentimes find it difficult to find individuals with disabilities. And that can be due largely to their many organizations and every community that serves different folks with different types of disabilities. And it can be a very confusing world for employers to interact with. And so sometimes it's just a matter of finding qualified individuals with disabilities.
So you said there are a lot of groups that work with people with disabilities. So why is it hard to make that connection then, John?
Well, I think that there are many groups. However, employers may not know which groups to connect with. And also, oftentimes, these various groups that are doing, that are trying to secure jobs for individuals with disabilities, one employer could receive multiple inquiries from different organizations, and it can be a bit confusing from the employer's perspective. And in some communities, they have attempted to bring these various organizations together that are securing jobs for people with disabilities and having one point of contact that all employers can go to.
Oh, that's interesting. Go ahead, Andrew, jump in.
Yeah, so I don't want to jump to the results of the study. We're not at that point yet. But one of the things that we found was that groups that use that interact with disability-related organizations in terms of recruiting, very few do, but every one of them that does founds it's a very effective way at recruiting individuals with disabilities. Now, we have had some feedback from folks saying, "Well, what do you mean, employers don't know where to find people with disabilities? There's all these job boards and all these different online resources." Well, as an employer, so Kim and I are both involved in hiring a few people, right? And when we interact with HR, the HR comes to us and says, "Well, where do you want to post this?" And we're like, "Well, we don't know. We just want to get qualified candidates, right?" And so I think there's a lot. This is actually something I think that's going to be worth, number one, doing further research on, which is not something I always want to say. But also we have a lot of open-ended responses that allow people to say, well, what's you know, provide verbal responses. So we're going to look into those data. But I think there's a lot of inertia, you know. So
on the part of who?
On a part of employers. In terms of reaching out to new networks, you know, and it's really in these kinds of times when there's lots of help wanted signs. I mean, we've posted jobs and gotten very few responses. Maybe it's being up in New Hampshire, a little bit too far away from the commute from Boston for say a research analyst. But the inertia is, you know, we have our given networks and we go to them and we have our given processes, and those processes might not adjust quickly to the availability of new information. So we'll post things on the UNH job openings website. We'll post things in the Chronicle of Higher Education. We'll post things in various places. But we don't necessarily actively go out and say, okay, we're going to grab this new area to find, and we're going to look for a specific type of individual. It's a very passive process for recruiting. It's not really recruiting. It's kind of casting a net.
So you're saying all of us have our own sort of traditional Sure. ways of looking for people, and they often don't include reaching out to people with disabilities or groups that
newer,
help those folks?
Or the newer resources that have been developed to support this initiative.
Huh. Interesting. Go ahead, Kim.
I agree with what Andrew is saying, and it just makes me think that, you know, Laura, we're all so busy, and we work at a really kind of rapid pace. And in order to be efficient and effective, we have habits and we create shortcuts. And I don't think that a lot of employers are able to sit and say, well, how might it benefit my organization if I make an extra effort to employ someone with a disability? So it requires sort of a pause in our daily way of going about things to stop and consider changing our practices just a little bit in order to open up to more people. So I don't think it's necessarily intuitive. It's not that people don't want to hire, or I think it's true that they often don't know, but just taking that pause to think outside the box isn't always the first thing.
So it's not deliberate. It's just people get busy and they go to the normal channels and they do it the normal way. And those normal ways, quote unquote, don't include groups that might have people with disabilities who are dying to work.
I think that's true. Yeah, to some extent. Yeah.
What do you think, John?
I would agree with him. I think that one of the hallmarks of an employer that's open to hiring individuals with disabilities is the deliberate effort to reach out to organizations that do work with individuals who have disabilities in the pursuit of employment. I would agree.
Okay. Well, we will gather more information and hear some stories about people with disabilities in the workforce, companies that have reached out to employ this group of, as we're hearing, underemployed Americans. And we'd love to hear from you, too. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, if you're a business owner, tell us your stories, give us your questions and concerns. Or if you have a disability yourself or are a family member of someone with a disability who's been trying to seek work, we'd love to hear from you as well. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. More in a moment.
Hey, Virginia Prescott.
Hey, Nick Capodice.
Give me the first U.S. president born in a hospital.
James Buchanan.
James Buchanan?
That's light.
Wasn't he our singlest president?
It's Jimmy Carter.
Seriously?
Seriously.
If you want to top that, come to NHPR's first ever Civics 101 Bar Trivia Night at True Brew Barista in Concord on Wednesday, October 25th at 7.
Virginia and I are hosting it. It'll be so fun. More info at nhpr.org.
So come on. You couldn't sound any stupider than I just did.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at people with disabilities who want to work, but as we're hearing, many are underemployed. They cannot find work working through the usual human resources networks. Sometimes it is hard for this group of Americans to find employment, even with a very low unemployment rate here in the Granite State. So we're looking at all this, including some research on how supervisors view this. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR. Exchange. Our guests for the hour are Andrew Houghtonville. He's director of research at the UNH, at the Institute on Disability at UNH. Kimberly Phillips is also with the Institute. She's with us as well. And John O'Neill joins us by phone. He's director of disability and employment research at the Kessler Foundation, based in New Jersey. And with us now is Nora Driscoll. She's program coordinator at LifeOp, a post-secondary education and vocational program at the Nashua Center for Young Adults Living with Developmental Disabilities. And Nora, really glad to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So what types of businesses do you tend to work with, Nora? You don't need to give us, you know, name names, but just give us a general sense of the types of firms that you are in contact with.
We have a variety of businesses that we work with. Some big companies, but where we find our most success is smaller businesses like mom and pops, companies, people who know us directly, and we really can get personal with us, and we are have much more success with that.
Now that's interesting. So small companies, you have more success placing people with disabilities than some of the big people.
Correct. I also have my job developer, Michelle Delaney, here, and she can speak to that, of why that is.
Well, that, yeah, go ahead. That, I, yeah, Michelle, Nora, I just want to keep you on the phone, okay? I think that might be a little difficult to go back and forth live on the air, but that is interesting that small companies.
Well, what happens with the big companies is that they expect us to be able, the employees that they hire, they expect them to come in and do all aspects of the job. So they would want them to be the cash register, run the cash register, you know, stock, do everything. And usually the people that we try to find employment for can do one or the other. They might not be able to do all aspects, but they might be able to do that one aspect very good.
So small employers, Nora, and do you tend to work more with retail or food service or office types of jobs? What types of jobs are we talking about, Nora?
I would say majority of office and some retail. We do have some. We have one student placed in a supermarket, but a lot of more office type work.
What type of office work? You know, are you talking about like answering phones and doing, you know, typing things? Or are you talking about sort of back of the office stuffing envelopes?
We do data entry, we do shredding, we do filling copiers, filing, stuffing envelopes, mail delivery, that kind of thing.
So all sorts of things. Who are the adults that you work with, Nora? What types of disabilities do they have?
We have students right now with us who have developmental disabilities.
Uh-huh.
We have a wide range. Some people might have cerebral palsy and they might be in a wheelchair. Some people are diagnosed with autism, but basically developmental disabilities is abroad.
Because that's, again, the focus of LifeOp. It's for young adults living with developmental disabilities.
Correct.
When you are matching up an employee with an employer, Nora, what do you have to think about or consider to make that connection successful?
We try to look, the match is a big thing, and all of our students are matched with job developer, and they are there to help train the student and the employees and create that relationship. We try to fade the job developer out of the picture, but many times they do stay with them. And we match. So if we have a quiet environment, you know, we have some students who might have some behaviors that are a little bit louder than the average person. You know, we definitely don't place them in a quiet environment. So we just look at their abilities and their disabilities and place them in a work environment that would work.
What's your role, Nora, once you identify someone who seems right for a job? What does your organization do at that point?
So I have a job developer on staff, and she goes out and does the normal, you know, looking for employment, filling out applications, meeting, going to job fairs, that kind of thing. And once she gets a connection, then she figures out who would be the best person for that job. She then works with the person, and she creates a resume, and we work on job interviewing skills and that kind of thing. She then brings the student in, and they set up an interview and do the regular thing that any person would do to get a job. And then once, you know, we hopefully get the job, we then work with the employer, and we do a whole training process. And sometimes it's unpaid until we actually learn the job. And then the pay might start as soon as the student can do all the skills of the job.
So people do get paid. It's not just, quote unquote, busy work. This is a job for folks.
Yes. All our students get paid. We have currently 11 people, students, adults, a mixture, because we also work with an older a day-hab program that has older clients in it. And they all get paid. And currently we have about 11 people who have paid employment.
What are some of the challenges, Nora, that businesses face in making this work, in making this connection successful?
I think a lot of the businesses are nervous about liability and insurance and how do we pay and, you know, but we just have to reassure them that it's the same as hiring any employee. You know, they're also worried about sick days and will they be able to get to work every day? And, you know, we just reassure them that they are just like any employee, and the statistics show that they're one of a better employee where they show up every day, they hardly have any sick days, you know, they're there on time. You know, because we really, really try to make sure all those things happen. But they're great employees.
What about transportation? Do you guys provide that? Because from what I understand, that's often an issue for people with disabilities. It's just they can't drive themselves to work. And in New Hampshire, there's not a lot of public transit.
Right. Some of our students, so we had one student at a department store, and we did travel training, and she learned how to use the city bus. You're in a good spot if you're in the middle of the city and you can use public transportation. If you're not, the job coach, that's a big responsibility. The job coach, they will make sure they get to and from their job on time, and they provide the transportation, you know, Nashua Center would.
What about the employee, Nora? Have you had a situation where one of your students has said, you know, this job isn't working for me, Nora, and here's why?
We have. You know, we run that risk, and depending on the circumstances, I've never had, well, maybe once we've had an employee come to us and say, we don't think this is working out. It's usually us, the center and the job developer and the job coach that might go to the employee and say, you know, this might be too hard, or this environment isn't working, you know, could we change it up? Or, you know, maybe, you know, and if our student or our client isn't happy as well, obviously we take them right out. But we then just try to follow through with, you know, we might have somebody else who might be better placed for this job. May we try that person? And that usually works out.
You know, Nora, earlier in the show, I'm not sure if you were listening, we talked with our guests in studio about why this group of Americans is often very underemployed. And all of them said that part of it is just inertia, if I could put it that way, that, you know, human resources departments have their usual places they go and their usual ways of reaching out and looking for employees. And not on purpose, but they just kind of overlook this group, this potential pool of workers. I wonder what you think about that. Not on purpose, but that, you know, people just don't think about reaching out to organizations like yours to look for potential employees.
Right, right. We do see that. I think they're nervous. I think if they don't understand this group of people, they might not know what they can do and can't. You know, but what we have found, like hiring people with disabilities, it's good business sense. We have found that once you bring a person with disabilities into the company, the other employees are like, oh, my cousin has a disability like this, or oh, you know, and usually they have some kind of connection, and it makes everybody around them feel good that their company is supporting people with disabilities. We have one company out in Nashua, and the person in there is doing filling copiers, doing the mail, shredding, and one by one, you know, at first people shied away and weren't too friendly, but then one by one, we got each employee, you know, they felt comfortable and were able to come say hello, and now everybody looks forward to when our person comes in and does work, and it's just made such a wonderful environment. But I think the benefits of the person with disabilities is as much as the people and the employees of the company. It goes hand in hand, and I think it's good for everyone.
Well, Nora, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Nora Driscoll, Program Coordinator at LifeOP, a post-secondary education and vocational program at the Nashua Center for Young Adults Living with Developmental Disabilities. Again, the number for you to join us with your comments, questions, personal experiences with this issue, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And John, Andrew, Kim, before we go to our listeners, a couple questions out of that conversation with Nora. Go ahead, Andrew. I think you wanted to jump in on something she said there.
Yeah, one of the, you know, I wrote down in my notes, hiring people with disabilities is contagious, that once you get over that nervousness of having somebody that may be a bit different and require a slightly different work pace and supports, it's seen that that person is valuable and that person provides a lot of productivity to the office, to the retail store. And, you know, I came into work in the 1980s, right, as a young student working summers and breaks in an accounting office. And women were really relegated in this office to kind of support, and all the the higher managers were men. And it was a very, this is right at Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas time. And it was a very male-oriented locker room mentality, right? And so I'm a young man coming in, and I'm at a university environment, but I don't see that anymore. And I think as more and more women came into the workforce in leadership roles, that went away, at least for me, what I observed. And the same thing I think can happen with people with disabilities as they come more and more into the workforce. People get used to it. And in some sense, men had to get over themselves and get over it. And people without disabilities kind of need to become more comfortable and kind of get over their own nerves. And I think that that's one of the kind of insidious thing about this low unemployment rate is that they're not in, people with disabilities are not in the workforce. So they're not gaining experience. People without disabilities aren't gaining the experience of working with them. And there are many other reasons for the underemployment. But I see it as something that's contagious and that keeps growing. And hopefully we'll see that in the statistics overall.
Well, and as Nora said, and what do you think, John, what's that nervousness about that Nora and Andrew mention?
Well, I think it exists. And I do know that when an employer takes the begins to take the risk, quote unquote, to hire individuals with disabilities, it does impact the culture of the organization, in the sense that in the effort to find ways to support and accommodate individuals with disabilities, supervisors often find ways to use those supports to provide accommodations to individuals without disabilities. So sometimes the overall corporate culture gets more flexible and more accepting of diversity generally.
Kim, you mentioned this earlier too at the beginning of the show that you know, employers may be going, well, I'm not sure if I want to create anything special for anybody. But you said earlier this actually helps everybody in the workplace. Give us an example of what you're talking about. Like, you're talking about job sharing, you're talking about flexible schedules. I mean, how might some of these accommodations actually help people who don't have a disability?
Okay, sure. Yeah. I think that well, there are a lot of misconceptions about what people with disabilities can do. I think Nora mentioned that. So what we've found in previous research is that there's also misconception about the types of accommodations that they will need. So employers tend to overestimate how costly and how difficult it will be to make accommodations for people with disabilities. But in reality, many times it just takes a little bit of flexibility, and the cost can be very low.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, sure. And these are the types of things that can benefit everyone. So adopting policies or practices where employees are sometimes able to work from home, or employees are able to shadow other employees on the job to learn more. Andrew wants to say something.
Oh, sorry.
Actually, I wanted to take a call first, because
sure.
We've got some people who want to jump into our conversation. And Mike is joining us from Southern New Hampshire. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. I had a question and a quick comment. I have a son who's a young man with developmental disabilities and a speech impediment, which makes it hard for him to be understood. He's been going to a local stable as a volunteer for many years, helping to feed and water the horses, take them from the stable out to the paddocks, and so on. And we've been working with them for a number of years and hoping that this could evolve into actually a career for him. At the stable, they've undergone a change of management, and the new folks don't seem to be as warm to working with people with disabilities. And I was wondering if there are ways that I might be able to approach them or other resources to help to kind of ease this transition and have them gain confidence. And just a quick comment, if I may, that, you know, folks with disabilities, you know, they have the challenges that they face due to their disability. But when other folks and individuals prejudge them, it's almost an added disability laid on top of it, which makes it much harder for those individuals to be able to succeed if they aren't given the opportunity.
Wow. Mike, thank you for calling in. And I'm sorry to hear that your son is having a hard time, because I'm sure he loves that work at the barn. What do you think, Andrew?
Yeah, so many times, you know, individuals with disabilities will get a job. It'll be very much crafted. There's something called customized employment and supported employment. And I think people don't change their minds by anything that you can say to them. Their experience with your son is what they need to see. And the more you can expose your son and expose them to the benefits of working with your son, the better. I don't know if there's anything you can tell someone to change their mind.
It just takes day-to-day experience being with that person. Mike, good luck to you, and thank you for the call. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. The number 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about employing adults with disabilities, talking with people who work in this field, and looking at some recent research about how supervisors feel about employing this group of often underemployed Americans. The number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. A couple emails I want to share with all of you. Here's one from Catherine, who says, my daughter suffered a stroke at age 4.5. Wow, Catherine. I knew we would face many challenges during her recovery and in her future. I knew my role was to research options, ignore limitations, as described by the experts, and to be her mentor and life coach. Catherine says, businesses often do not understand the hidden handicaps that any employee holds, especially one with a defined disability. Catherine says, folks with challenges of any kind need a mentor who understands their social and emotional challenges, as well as their physical challenges. She says, many need a foundation in a skill, a college degree or other training, but navigating that requires funding and a pace that allows them to meet with small successes. And Catherine, I can't read the whole email, but thank you so much for telling us about your daughter, who is now 25 and, based on your email, seems to be doing quite well. What do you think about this, John, that sometimes a person with disabilities who wants to get into the workforce, who has a lot to offer, just needs someone to kind of help them along?
Well, Andrew had mentioned customized employment a while ago, and that's a process of whereby the organization, the staff that's working with folks, will spend a lot of time getting to know the individual's preferences and their particular what they enjoy, and then will craft a job within a company that meets the individual's specific interests. And that does require some flexibility on the part of an employer. They may want to take different job functions and sort of bring them together such that the job works for the corporation, for the company, and also for the individual.
Well, Catherine, thank you for the email. And let's go back to our listeners. Ransom's calling from Bennington. Hi, Ransom. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Laura. It's good to be on. I'm actually a DSP, a direct support professional. I work for a company called Monadnock WorkSource in Peterborough, New Hampshire. And I work as a job coach and as support for people with cognitive and physical challenges. I work at several different businesses around the area with the clients that I work with who are adults, and I've really enjoyed the ability to do this, and I have actually learned so much from the clients that I work with. And I think one of the most important things, well, a couple of points is one thing that I remember reading several years ago is a saying about presumed competence, which is, you know, to really not see the impairment that somebody may have, but see the benefit that they can provide for a company or in whatever they're doing.
Presumed competence, Ransom, that's what you said, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Presumed competence. And I think that's one of the things that when you do get out into the workforce with the individuals, helping them to advocate for themselves as well as advocating for them is a really crucial thing.
Ransom, I want to get our listeners in on, I mean, our guests in on this, but quick question for you. I'm interested about your experiences. We talked earlier about businesses, employers just being nervous sometimes. What do you think they're nervous about?
Well, I think it has more to do with us as people and not always having an objective view of things. And I think one of the terms that I use is judging people using their yardstick instead of yours, because I think that one of the things that causes uncertainty with people is that we're not seeing the person objectively with what they can provide for us, and more out of a need that we're going to have to provide something for them.
Okay.
And I think that's really difficult to, you know, to sort of turn off once you get to a business and the people start seeing the productivity and the amount of care and the amount of skill that the people have. That quickly disappears.
Well, Ransom, it's good to hear from you. And go ahead, Kim, you had a thought there.
I did. Thank you. That's so interesting. And also the email from Catherine. But presume competence makes me think that really what we want from employers, from everyone, is for them to look at people with disabilities, look at the whole person, not just looking at the disability. And, you know, that's an example that you asked me before, Laura, of how it can benefit everyone, not just people with disabilities. So if employers are really taking a moment to look at us all as whole people, then and presuming our competence and understanding that we all bring skills and deficits to the table, that's something that's going to help empower the workforce as a whole.
Well, and make the workplace more attractive. We've talked on this show so many times about work-life balance, people with young children, people with, you know, ailing spouses or ailing parents.
Right.
So that's part
right.
of that.
And it goes back to, even as we were saying, that not all disabilities are visible. So employers don't always know which of their employees have disabilities. So
let's take another call. This is Jim in Manchester. Hi, Jim. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
My point that I'd like to make is that, well, one, I'll describe my background. One, we have two kids with disabilities. They're in their 20s now. And we created a program many years ago in the Manchester area that we called Peer Work. And the model that we created was a little bit different. We believed that we should focus on changing the way you look at people working and really take the job coach model. I should actually add that I mostly understand people with disabilities having cognitive impairments, not other impairments that are out there. And the job coach model, which I believe needs to change, and more we could get a more peer-to-peer or natural supports within the employer, would help a lot more. Because if you look, one of the reasons I think that there's fear within this whole the employers is they think that they're either going to get a job coach in there who's going to sit and watch this person with disabilities do their work, rather than getting natural supports where the other employers work. It's a very, very different idea that you take people with disabilities, and instead of treating them like every other employee where you have coworkers that work with them, we bring in a job coach often who actually sits and doesn't do the work that the person with the disability does.
I have a basic question, Jim, about job coaches since we've been talking about this. So is a job coach usually someone from an outside organization like Nora Driscoll's organization, LifeOp, or is it someone within the workplace itself, or is it a family member? Who is a job coach?
That's a very good question. It's all over the place. Oftentimes, an agency will bring in the job coach. Sometimes it is a family member. We do know friends whose mothers have gone in, mostly mothers, but there have been fathers who have gone into the workplace and have actually worked with their children one-on-one to help them learn the job. But if you look at traditional working environment, I don't have anybody who is my job coach. I have supervisors, I have coworkers. And so if we could change this model to be much more of a coworker type environment, I know it's a big change. I'm not expecting the world to suddenly come this way, but I think it would help a lot.
Well, Jim, thank
you. The other point that
what's that? I was gonna have our guests respond to what you said, but if you want to make another point real quick, that'd be great.
So the other point that I want to make is one of saturating the market for looking for places for employment. So if you take the traditional job coach and or staff that's out there, the way I look at looking for jobs is, and I've seen in other literature, you take and write down 110 people that you know in your family. Then you call each one of those 10 people and you ask them for 10 names of people that they could call to look for employment. Then you take those 10 people and you ask for 10 people who they could call.
Well, that's a good employment strategy no matter what issues you have. Jim, thank you for calling. It's good to hear from you. There's an email that I want to share with all of you before we close out, because I think this is an important point, too. Iris emailed. She said, I'm a disabled person, and one of the things that concerns me regarding working with SSDI, and I'm guessing that's Social Security
Disability Insurance.
Thank you. Is the loss of benefits that can occur. Yeah. Medicare and state Medicaid benefits all have monetary guidelines. Yeah. Loss of prescription drug coverage is also a problem. Iris says, thank you for the show. Iris, thank you. And all of you, maybe you first, John O'Neill. You know, you mentioned earlier that most of the time when people with disabilities have jobs, they get paid because they're working. How does that affect the benefits that they might get from the state or the federal government, John?
Well, it's a very complex answer to that question, but it depends upon the type of benefit. For example, if someone's receiving supplemental security income, there are work incentives in place such that one can always take home more money by working than not. And also in many states, you can maintain your health insurance. Even if you work above the substantial gainful activity level, if you're receiving supplemental security income for disability insurance, it's fairly complex and it can be a barrier for many people.
Yeah, if you make too much money, you lose some of those benefits.
Yes,
yeah.
You lose the benefits, and there are incentives, but from my perspective, they don't work as well as they could.
Although at a certain level, Andrew, you know, the argument could go, you should lose those benefits. You're making a decent salary, so why should you get Medicaid or more Social Security Disability Insurance?
That's right. So my father was on Social Security Disability Insurance and was sued by in 1980 by the federal government for working too much. And, you know, it's a real – Social Security is kind of the elephant in the closet, the Social Security programs. Many people with disabilities are utilizing these programs, but they kind of get stuck on those programs. Once you're in those programs, it's very difficult. Very few people move off those programs, because, as the caller said, you know, there's this fear of losing your benefit. And John mentioned there's work incentives. There's these very complex programs. The fact of the matter is, I have good friends of mine, two PhD economists with a daughter who's in her early 20s with Down syndrome, works for Wegmans Corporation, which is one of the best employers in the Northeast.
It's a food retailer.
It
right?
is. Yeah. It's there's one down in Burlington, Mass. But they're from Rochester and they're kind of expanding. Hopefully they'll come out this way. It's a great supermarket, and it takes two PhD economists to manage her time and her paperwork.
Wow.
For Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. It's just such a complex process. You know, these are based on the ability to work, but there's a real hard problem with, you know, if you support an individual, it has to, you know, and that person gets to work, starts working, how do you back away the benefits without leaving that person in the lurch? And it's this real dynamic.
Yeah, and it's a judgment call. How much is too much in terms of working, in terms of money?
Right.
These are taxpayer programs, so
right.
You know, you don't want people who are making $100,000 a year to be pulling down Social Security,
no,
although
that's
I'm guessing that your friend's daughter isn't making that much
no.
money.
You know, one of the really neat things about disability research, disability policy, disability programs is that they're very actually bipartisan in nature, and this is the one kind of thing that many of your listeners are probably thinking about policy and that, oh, well, this may be very expensive to have job coaches and things like that and supports like that. But it's really bipartisan in the sense that on the right side, there wants to be individuals working, being part, you know, paying their taxes, not being on programs. And on the left side of the aisle, people, you know, advocates want individuals to be integrated in society and to be expecting them to work. That this is a place where you actually want to expect individuals to work, and why mentors, I forget the caller's name, sorry, talked about her daughter and needing examples. The whole idea is to expect work and to be able to vision people working with disabilities, and it ends up being very bipartisan in my experience. You know, everybody wants individuals with disabilities to be working, to be either part of society, paying taxes, and to be integrated.
Well, it's been more than a quarter century since the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed. Seems amazing. In terms of employment, what do you think, Kim? What have we learned over that time and what haven't we learned?
Well, we've certainly learned that people with disabilities are striving to work. And I think we've learned that employers are open to the idea of hiring, you know, recruiting, hiring, training, and promoting people with disabilities when they know how to do it. What haven't we learned? There are still a lot of misconceptions, and like Ransom said, about what people can do. I think people with disabilities can do a lot more than sometimes employers are expecting them to be able to do. And I don't think we've quite nailed the workplace culture situation, as Jim was pointing out with his peer-to-peer, you know, cause.
Yeah. Jim in Manchester, who called, who has two adult kids with disabilities right. in the workforce. Well, all of you, thank you very much for being here. We'll put links on our website to the study that we touched on about supervisor perspectives on employing people with disabilities. John O'Neill, thank you for coming to the phone with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
That's John O'Neill, Director of Disability and Employment Research at the Kessler Foundation in New Jersey. That's a national organization which helps connect people with disabilities with employers. And Kimberly Phillips, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kimberly Phillips is project director at the Institute on Disability at UNH, co-principal investigator of that Kessler Foundation Supervisor Perspectives Survey. And Andrew Houghtonville, it was really nice to meet you too. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Andrew Houghtonville is director of research at the Institute on Disability at UNH, also worked on the survey. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Christina Phillips and Jessica Hunt. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.